listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And we're now beginning our sixth year of Connect the Dots, the Connect the Dots program. So for the last 5 years, and now we're going into our sixth, we've been with you every Wednesday connecting the dots between our personal health and our total health environment. I'm a long-standing journalist of health, food, and the environment, broadened out from all the way from giving health advice and recommendations to looking at policies and what we do in our society and how to take action to create a pro-health society. Every week on Connect the Dots, we talk to different experts, advocates, authors, all about the different facets of all of the different things in our world that affect our health, little and big picture. And today we're going to be focusing on our policy side and speaking to two guests who have been incredible organizers in the world of policy, working on a crucial issue which I've covered, you know, devoted almost all of 2015 to covering, you know, on the show last year, and we're moving forward this year to keep covering it. And the thing that's so great about it is that we've really had better success covering the toxic trade deals, the TPP and others, all of the people who've been taking action, the way the cries have been heard, the coverage, of course, outside in general of mainstream media that we've received have been due to your participation in the work of some terrific organizers, and we have two leaders in that arena with us on today's show. They are Margaret Flowers, MD, and Kevin Zeese. They are the founders of this It's Our Economy, as well as Flush the TPP, and they have spearheaded the strategy, the thinking, and the actions that have, although the treaty has been limping forward, really stalled it and galvanized people and educated people as to what these treaties are about. Margaret Flowers is co-director with Kevin Zeese of It's Our Economy. She's a Maryland pediatrician who has been very active in trying to advocate for single-payer health care system at both the state and national levels, and she's been organizing around the TPP issue, and actually later in the time you'll find out how to participate in phone calls and actually get updates and hear what's going forward in regular calls that Flush the TPP organizes that Margaret and Kevin organize. Kevin is an attorney who's been a political activist since graduating from the George Washington Law School in 1980. He works on peace, economic justice, criminal law reform, and reviving American democracy. And of course, as regular listeners will know, the trade deals, the toxic trade deals, are a terrible threat to our economy, to our democracy, to freedoms and rights we take for granted, as well as to the ecological balance of planet Earth. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Margaret and Kevin.
Thank you for having us, Allison.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, so today's show follows yesterday's State of the Union address, and I'd love to hear your thoughts and responses to the signals that President Obama was saying, ascending on trade as well as on the environment in yesterday's State of the Union address.
Yeah, well, it was about an hour-long speech, and it wasn't until about 45 minutes into it that he discussed or mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I haven't taken the time yet, but I'd love to go through his whole speech and compare the things he promised that were inconsistent with the TPP as far as his hopes for the economy and, you know, ending the wealth divide and all those kinds of issues that were so opposite the TPP. I guess the surprise was that he spent so little time on it and put it so late into his speech. It really showed kind of a deprioritization or less emphasis for some reason. Maybe it's strategic. I don't know what the rationale was, but he certainly did not play it up. It was about a three-line comment, and Speaker Ryan, who is maybe the most important person as far as getting the process going in Congress, because the House will consider the TPP first, he didn't react to the TPP comment. There was about a smattering of small applause in the congressional audience, and so it wasn't very much. Now, you know, there's also what was interesting about it was the build-up to the State of the Union, where you started to see people drawing their lines. The business community solidified its support for it. The opposition showed its opposition more widely. We had a letter delivered signed by 1,500 organizations opposing the TPP. There was a press event with Rosa DeLauro and other members of Congress and some unions and the Farmers Association coming out against the TPP. So support was shown on both against it and for it. Both sides kind of solidified their views. Where we go from here, it's unclear. Supposedly it'll be signed on February 4th, and that would be a time when Obama could begin the process once he submits the legislation needed to allow Congress to consider it. He can submit that legislation anytime after it's signed. But there are also reports that the Trade Commission has been putting out a report on the economic impact of TPP, and that's not due to mid-March. And there are some reports in the media that say that that will be submitted along with the implementing legislation. So we may not see anything until mid-March. So it's all very vague, up in the air still. A lot of the fireworks expected from TPP being discussed didn't happen. Our sense is that we have to keep building. We're planning a series of protests on February 4th and mid-February when the members are home from for the presidential week. And so we're going to keep building and working towards stopping this TPP this election year. Maybe Mark has more to add.
Yeah, I think what was really interesting is that, you know, up until the State of the Union, the White House has been saying how the TPP is, you know, it's going to boost the economy and create, you know, good-paying jobs and be good for small business and all these kind of, you know, ensure a free and open Internet, all these things that they've been saying that actually have been shown to be not factually correct. He didn't say any of those in his speech. He really only boiled it down to two things, which he's been saying over and over for the past few years, that, you know, it's going to cut 18,000 taxes. That's not actually not going to make a difference. He's talking about import tariffs, and we don't want China to set the rules. So he really, you know, it was interesting to see that those were the only two things I think he felt safe saying, but he sent a lot of signals throughout the speech of what his real agenda is. He said, you know, America, you know, the United States is strong when we have a thriving private sector. And of course, mm-hmm. we know that agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership are going to move to greater privatization of things like our health care and management of water, you know, public services. He also said that there are a lot of pesky regulations that get in the way of things. And of course, mm-hmm. you know, that's another area where the Trans-Pacific Partnership and these other agreements are really about doing away with regulations for, you know, industries. He also said that we are going to sell the energy of the future and how great, you know, the U.S. has been in reforming the energy sector. Well, what does that look like to our president? We look at the Clean Power Plan. It's really about selling more gas and building more nuclear power plants. And, of course, this gas largely comes from fracking, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership actually paves the way for a smoother export of gas to Asian nations. Particularly Japan is very interested in getting more gas from the United States. And what is that fracking and those pipelines, those compressor stations, those all hurt, you know, our communities here. So if you knew kind of what the Trans-Pacific Partnership does and you listened to his speech, you could hear him, you know, saying what his agenda is, and it's not something that's good for us. So it is really critical that we be aware of this and that we continue to fight this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my impression was it's almost like if you don't name the elephant, then it doesn't become a target. And given the fact that this has been undercovered in the mainstream media, there's probably little value to him as he's coming down the last several weeks to February 4th, you know, to identify this big elephant rather than leave it nameless.
Exactly.
So, I mean,
that has been the strategy of passing the TPP from the beginning. You know, mm-hmm. keep it quiet, classify it, don't let anyone see it, don't give the news, media any reason to cover it. Let's get this flipped and under the radar. So that's always been the strategy. So that's actually very consistent with what how they've approached this trade agreement.
Mm-hmm. And so if it's this big mystery, you know, there were some exchanges yesterday on my Facebook page when I posted your analysis, your pre-analysis of the key mm-hmm. points. And, you know, there was one of my Facebook friends who is not that well informed, but, you know, he kind of had some general fear-based comments that really showed a lack of knowledge and a sense of mystery. So, you know, these big points that, you know, they kind of have made central, whether it's China or whatever, scare people into thinking this must be right. You know, the other thing about this that I find that is cognitively dissonant for many people, and, you know, there's a more colorful way of describing that I won't use on the air, but so let's say cognitively dissonant, which is a more Latinate expression of it, which is, you know, on the one hand, you know, the president will make statements about the environment and, you know, crushing climate deniers on the side of science. And so it's almost like a distraction technique or something. And so everyone who is environmentally concerned will be singling out that statement and applauding and kind of feeling a sense of relief that the president gets it and he's on the case. And then the actual substance of the things that he's supporting are carrying forth a completely different agenda, as you point out, with, you know, fracking and gas pipelines and the trade deals, the TPP and other trade deals that will unleash the development of natural gas and liquefied natural gas for export while poisoning and contaminating our communities. You know, what about that incredible inconsistency? This, I think, confuses people because they kind of go, you know, on the one hand, the environmentalists are sort of happy for any side. We've progressed the conversation. He's on our side, you know. And meanwhile, there's this covert agenda that's occurring that they're not drilling into and seeing that the two are should be connected.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, Obama is a master politician that way, that he can say things that if you don't understand what he's actually done with his policies, they can sound, you know, really great. And I think one thing that's important for listeners to understand is, you know, not only do these agreements make it easier and drive more fracking and processing and export of dirty energy, like gas, which I hate to call it natural because it's really methane, and methane is such a potent greenhouse gas, you know, much more than mm-hmm. CO2. But not only that, but it will prevent us and our communities from stopping this. So as your listeners may have heard, you know, many applauded President Obama recently when he ended, you know, the permit for the northern portion of the Keystone Pipeline, the KXL. And shortly after that, TransCanada, the company that's building the pipeline or wanted to, actually initiated a lawsuit under a trade agreement against the United States for $15 billion. So this is what's going to happen if we in our communities try to ban fracking or prevent pipelines or try to stop the nuclear power plants. Those corporations that own them can then sue us. It's happening also in Canada. There's a company called Lone Pine Resources, which operates solely inside of Canada. It's a Canadian company, but they incorporated in Delaware in the United States so that they would be considered a foreign investor and have the rights to sue their own government. So they're suing Canada because the area of the St. Lawrence River Basin, they banned fracking there, and this company wants to frack there. So this is kind of the future that we'll face under these agreements. It's pretty scary.
You know, what do you think about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Bill McKibben were recently both quoted, and the good news was that they seem to finally be talking about these trade deals. Bill McKibben, you know, I mean, 350.org was nominally against them, but I never heard a single statement up until very recently from Bill McKibben himself about them. They were, 350 was focusing on divestment of, of investment in, gas and oil companies and that kind of thing, and that was their sort of chief target. But recently, you know, he pointed out in the wake of this lawsuit the ill effect that this could have, as did Robert F. Kennedy. But they both kind of dismissed, in a way, rather than characterizing these deals as dangerous, they kind of dismissed them and as kind of like, oh, this is ridiculous, this is absurd, it shouldn't happen, you know, it'll never, it kind of almost implied it'll never happen. So instead of galvanizing people, they were critical, but they did so in a way that didn't really alert to the threat and the timely window that we have now in the next few weeks to take action. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I
mean, it's a bit of a curveball there.
Yeah, 350 has been a kind of mixed bag on this for the movement. They, you know, at the local level, there have been some really great 350 organizations that have joined in the movement to stop the TPP. We've seen that in a bunch of different cities. But the national level was never seemed to be the priority. And you didn't hear very much out of leadership of 350. They were focused on COP21, and, you know, their agenda seemed full to them. And taking on this task is a big task. So I think the TransCanada lawsuit definitely helped to finally get a light bulb starting to turn on, but I think it's one of these new light bulbs that turn on gradually. they have to warm up. So it kind of did galvanize that. And what we've been saying throughout, one of the key points we've been trying to make to the environmental movement, and a lot of groups get it, Sierra Club, you know, they're doing a call today with communication workers to organize around this issue, but a lot don't get it. And so we've been saying throughout that it doesn't matter what happens at COP21. These trade agreements will trump it. These trade agreements are binding. Both the European version and the Asian version are both pushing for more of the same old dirty energy. And so we're going to see more fracked gas. We're going to see more oil exports. Oil exports are going to begin again. We're going to see all these kind of negative backward steps because these trade agreements protect current financial interests. And current financial interests are the old carbon energy sources. And so we're hoping that the light is turning on, that it's getting warmer, and that the 350.org will start to see it and make it a major national push. They have a very large base of support as far as numbers of people go. They can make a very big difference in pushing things forward. So we hope that this is a good beginning, that they're actually seeing the reality. One of the problems, I think, in galvanizing people is the timing is so unsure. Mitch McConnell is still saying it's not going to happen without the election. Paul Ryan is saying nothing. The chair of Ways and Means, which is where first go, is saying there's still some work to do. So it's unclear, so it's hard to for an organization to say, let's make this an issue now because it's really going to happen. We don't know when it's going to happen. It may not happen until 2017. It may not happen until the lame duck session, or it may happen in February. And so I think that's one of the challenges. We have to really keep pushing them, letting them, keeping them involved, letting them know, and hoping that the light will get really bright and that they will jump in at the right moment to make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Also, one of the things that I wondered about during the entire fight of last year when the light bulb had not turned on, one of the things I wondered was, were these large groups hoping to get concessions from President Obama, like his refusal to allow the Keystone XL or his, tabling of it or however, that kind of thing unfolded? Was that what they were making their top priority? And, therefore, they didn't want to criticize him as the one, mm-hmm. representing begging for all of that, these trade deals, you know, and sort of sour that possibility. And then, of course, he did go forward to do what they had hoped. But then, ironically, it was undone by the, you know, I mean, it can be undone, and it's now being challenged by this lawsuit. So, you know, your thoughts on that, because, you know, it's kind of like the nature of marketing is that you kind of, or branding a, or an organization having an initiative is that, you know, you kind of speak to one idea, and then if you make progress pushing, or appear to make progress pushing the dial forward on that, everyone is happy, and they you know, they come back and they want to reengage, whereas it's extremely disturbing not to win anything. So you have these wins, but then they're, you know, kind of undone by you know, this current lawsuit. They're undone by the fact that the trade deals will be binding, while, you know, the COP provisions are non-binding agreements. So, you know, it, you appear to have one step forward, but then it's actually two steps back, or more. Your comments on that, and public perception of this and these organizations.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And I think for these large organizations that have large budgets and they need to continue to fund the large number of staff that they have, mm-hmm. I think they feel that it's very important to keep putting wins out there to show people that they're making progress and you know, to keep that support coming in. I think it's I think that you're right that when you compromise, I guess it's a different way to look at power. I mean, I don't really have any trust in the Obama administration to be concerned about the health and safety of people. I don't really trust this Congress that is so tightly controlled by wealth interests to do what's right by the people without significant pressure on them to do that. It just goes contrary to the way the power balance is right now, which is with the wealth and the big industries. And so I think it's important for us to be pushing in a very strong way, in a very clear and honest way about what the situation is, and not think that, oh, well, maybe if I'm nice, they'll give me a little bone. I think that we need to be in there, you know, with a power fist saying, you know, these are the things that you're doing. They're hurting us, and you need to stop doing them. And that's the only way that we're going to get real, you know, real changes that we need. I just couldn't see going to the administration and saying, you know, please don't build this pipeline while these other terrible things are going on that are going to, you know, really make that not even worth winning. I don't know if that makes sense, but I just think that we need to be pretty clear in this political environment that it is going to take all of us very loudly demanding and exposing the corruption and demanding what we need in order to get what we need.
You know, I think that there's movements are made up of a wide variety of people and organizations, you know, that cover a lot of different approaches from, you know, radicals, and I consider Margaret in the radical camp, you know, idealists, realists, opportunists, and, you know, and I think there's all sorts of organizations like that. Those are kind of four key categories. And first off, from our perspective in the radical side, mm-hmm. our job is to put forward the real solutions, highlight the real failures, and be independent of the power structure, except for those who we can pull to our side so we can build the movement. And the stronger that we are, the more we can pull the groups that are, you know, more in the realistic or, you know, what can we really get done kind of attitude to our side. And so we see, you know, and the problem is a lot of these groups are in the position of what can we actually accomplish this position and are not completely independent of the Democratic Party or the Obama administration. They all have a lot of issues in front of them. Like the AFL-CIO, for example, they cover mm-hmm. a lot of important issues on worker rights, and they have mm-hmm. to balance other issues they're working on with issues like the TPP. Now, the AFL CIO and the other big unions have come to the conclusion, the correct conclusion, that the TPP will undermine everything they're working for. That if you lose the TPP and you lose the transatlantic trade agreement, that will really undermine workers in the United States and around the world. So they have made this a top priority, and they are really going to the mat on this, and that's, I think, really key. I think a group like 350 didn't really, they haven't been around as long. AFLs have been, and the unions have been fighting these trade agreements since the late 80s, I mean, late 90s. And so I think there's a bit of a learning curve that's happening with these, with a group like 350. They don't realize the power of these agreements. They don't realize how hard they are to stop. They don't realize the interests that are behind them. Are their opponents, or the major oil and gas industry corporations are who are pushing it, Wall Street's who's pushing it, and I think they don't quite get it yet. And so, trade agreements are hard to understand. So they have other agenda items. There are a lot of criticisms of the KXL fight, not just from the perspective of the TPP, but also from the perspective of Obama laying down thousands of miles of infrastructure for oil and gas right now while we're fighting the KXL. And luckily other people at the grassroots level are fighting those other pipelines and compressor stations and export terminals, and so those are being fought in other ways. But I think that 350 still has some learning to do on how to balance these issues and how to keep their independence from the Obama administration. And I remember mm-hmm. they're doing these big protests where they wanted to make sure they wore their Obama 2008 button to show they supported the president. So I think there's a problem there, and I think they've gotten better. I think they've gotten smarter, and I think they've done a lot of great work, but I think they really got to recognize that these agreements are significant. I think the Sierra Club gets it because they've been around for a while, too. They've seen these fights as well. They've been on the wrong side sometimes, and so I think they've made that mistake already, and they're not making it again. I think they realize that these agreements affect everything they're working for as far as environmental protection and climate change. So mm-hmm. it's a learning curve, and it's we have to do our job better in order to pull people to the perspective that we cannot compromise on this. This is something that has to be stopped. That's our job, as far as a movement perspective job, pulling the movement in that direction.
And listeners, if you're interested, you can go to Flush the TPP online and get articles, updates, get invited to meetings, participate in actions, both online and at events of various kinds that Kevin and Margaret organize. You know, let's just talk for a moment a little bit about the current Keystone XL lawsuit. That is being filed under NAFTA. I have sort of a two-pointed question. Point one is a lot of people say, find it hard to believe that under the investment state provisions, U.S. law would in effect be subject to overrule by the terms of these trade deals, leading to a kind of corporate overrule where if any environmental laws, bans, or health or environmental laws or bans, or wishes of various communities contradicted any kind of corporate or industrial initiative, then those taxpayers would be subject to compensating the corporations. That's really the switcheroo, the big switcheroo that's kind of going on here. Now, people tend to dismiss that on the face of it because it's when you say radical, I mean, to me, that is radical. That is a radical change in our democratic structures as we've known them and assumed them to be. So many people find it hard to believe that would ever happen, and then they kind of dismiss it out of hand. Oh, that couldn't ever happen. Now, it's been said that because of these kind of the super locomotive of these coming trade deals being on track, literally on fast track to be signed by the president, that there has been an underuse of these provisions, which do exist under NAFTA, the current lawsuit being filed under NAFTA, because, the other treaties have yet to be passed and enacted. So my question to you is, from your point of view, do you consider it credible that there's been a kind of holdback, let's not file and really alert people to what we're going to have a lot more of under these treaties? And secondly, how much worse do these provisions get in terms of their reach and power under the coming treaties than as compared to what they are under NAFTA?
Great questions. Yeah, it is kind of hard for people to believe that these kinds of kangaroo courts, these trade tribunals where the judges are mostly corporate lawyers, has the power to overrule federal down to local laws, and that there's no court review in the United States. The Supreme Court cannot overrule what these trade tribunals decide. And, you know, we have seen recently not just the KXL suit, but we've seen some decisions under the NAFTA court system, which is the same court system that we're going to have under TPP. It's all part of the same tribunal system. The difference is going to be that we're going to have a lot more corporations able to sue. Just by TPP alone, with its current membership, and this talk of expanding the number of countries, 9,000 other corporations, new corporations, will be able to sue under these investor-state trade dispute laws. So that's pretty amazing. 9,000 more, and if we add more countries, that'll be even bigger. Can you imagine if China gets included, and they invest a lot in the United States, and they will be able to sue to overrule U.S. laws? So two examples recently that, you know, dealing with food, which is a key issue, our health and safety, you know, starts with what we put into our bodies. And the COOL Act, which was the country of origin labeling for meat, the trade tribunal found that that was a trade violation, and the United States was forced to repeal this very popular law that let us know where our meat came from. And then the second one was the Dolphin Safe Tuna labeling, again found to be a violation of the trade agreements, the NAFTA trade agreement, a lawsuit filed by Mexico. And we're required now to stop that labeling, which a lot of people like because they wanted to, you know, protect dolphins, who are pretty highly sentient beings, and didn't want their, you know, tuna to be the cause of the death of dolphins. And so those are both repealed. One is repealed, one's going to be repealed. And so, and there's no court review here. And so the trade tribunals and those trade agreements basically trump U.S. law. So the KXL now is a very highlighted one, and it's really poorly timed for Obama as far as the passage of TPP, because it was a very high-profile political dispute in the United States. A lot of environmental groups, a lot of climate groups got heavily involved and heavily invested in that fight, and so the fact that that now can be all overturned, you know, has raised people's consciousness. As far as the concept of, you know, were corporations holding back, it's hard to tell what's in a, even though they're human, it's hard to tell what's in their mind. But I think they're just like with people. There's a whole range of different kinds of corporations and with different corporate interests. Right now, tar sands are under a lot of financial pressure. A number of tar sands projects have been stopped because of the price of oil has dropped so much. And TransCanada is not doing that well financially because of that. And so they are maybe a little desperate for funds. And $15 billion coming in from a lawsuit like this would be something they may need, may force the pipeline to build, which would lower the price of transport of tar sands to the Gulf. So their corporate interests may have trumped the political interests. And so they're maybe just a little different than where other corporations are. But so, you know, I can't say that all corporations act with one intent. They have a whole lot of different factors that they're balancing. But this is a very real thing. We've seen it used against the United States and around the world, these trade tribunals, to undermine law and policy of nations through these lawsuits and these arbitration courts. And so, yes, this is real, and this is a very important reason to stop this undermining of democracy and the sovereignty of nations.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add a little bit to that, some of those 9,000 corporations that have legal standing are foreign-based, you know, foreign companies that are operating within the United States. So they have, if the TPP passes, will have the right to sue our U.S. government over things like wages, minimum wages, or environmental protections, or other, you know, worker rights or, you know, laws that protect communities, whereas the companies that are from the U.S. operating in the U.S. will not have those same rights. So it gives them, it gives the foreign corporations an advantage. And what we see in that kind of a situation is that it just starts this race to the bottom, because then U.S. companies have to cut corners to be able to compete with the other companies that are able to pay their workers less or get away with polluting and not having to pay for cleanup or things like that. And then another group that's being included under, in the TPP that's new to this investor-state dispute settlement process is financial corporations. And so, you know, at a time, I don't know if your listeners have seen The Big Short. I recommend it. It's a very good movie that shows the corruption in the banking industry and on Wall Street. And at the point where we are now in the U.S., that corruption is still running rampant, and there are a lot of risky investments out there that are unstable and could threaten the economy. And so we can see these financial industries suing in order to protect themselves from, you know, having to pay up if they crash the economy, or having to put in place protections that would allow them to not be able to make these risky investments. So, you know, it's, I think in so many ways, whether it's our health, whether it's, you know, our workers, the environment, our economy, you know, this kind of court that operates solely for the interest of the corporate profits, and where we don't have the right as people to sue if we are being harmed, I think that's one of the most concerning things about the agreement. And it's something that in the European agreement, TAFTA, or Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, people in Europe have been, you know, really loudly protesting that, and it's been causing them to maybe make even some changes in that chapter. So something we need to be louder about here.
How aware do you think people are, Americans are, of these treaties? You know, how do you think that educational process, how we've been doing, and what can listeners do to advance it and let other people know?
Well, really, when you consider the circumstances that this was largely, you know, was negotiated in secret, that members of Congress, if they did go through all the steps to read it, then weren't really allowed to talk about specifics of it, but there was a very concerted media blackout, I think that the movement has done a very good job of educating a number of people to the point where they were willing to get out there and take action to pressure their members of Congress and do some protests in the street. But if you, you know, go out into the general public, you're going to see that there's still a lot of people who really have no idea what this is or what it means. I mean, when we first started doing this work years ago, when we would speak to a group of activists, and we consider, you know, activists are generally pretty politically aware, there maybe be 10% of the room that had heard of the TPP, but over the years, we found that that greatly increased to where, you know, 70, 80% of people would raise their hand and would say, you know what the TPP is. So that has largely come about because of people in their communities taking action through a variety of different things. We did things called TPP Tuesdays, where people would go out to very highly trafficked areas and hold signs, maybe over highways, like on bridges, or they would go to transportation stations, like train stations and metro stations, and hand out flyers. We know that a lot of people have organized teach-ins in their communities to educate people about this. So this has largely been kind of a person-to-person spreading of information, and we need to continue to do that. And one of the things about TPP that's advantageous and also terrible is that it affects everything we care about. So it means that really any group that someone is involved with is probably a group that would be interested in hearing about the TPP. So it does give us an opportunity, and we have over the years created this movement of movements that's very diverse, people that care about food or health or the environment, workers, what internet, the economy. So people need to first inform themselves. And if you go to flushthetpp.org and you click on the tools for education, there are there's information there, general information as well as information divided up by issues that you may care about. There are sample flyers that people can download. We also have something called the TPP OccuCard. It's a colorful postcard with a graphic on the front and then information on the back, and people can order those and hand them out in various areas. And then we have organizing calls, national organizing calls, every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And people are welcome to join those calls. We have a number of actions that are coming up in February around the president's signing of the agreement, and also when members of Congress are at home in their districts in mid-February. And we're already starting to talk about the next phase of actions after that. So we just need to keep growing, spreading, raising awareness. And I think that what's going to be key to stopping this that we learned in the fast track fight is that it can't just be lobbying our members of Congress and asking them, you know, please don't vote for this. They're getting their arms twisted by industry and by the administration. The Obama administration had its staffers up on the Hill throughout the spring pushing on our members of Congress to pass fast track. And even the president went to the Capitol Hill himself on the day of a vote, emergency visit to Capitol Hill to twist arms of the Democrats to get them to vote for fast track. So we're going to have to apply even greater pressure from the outside. And that does mean we need to be loud and we need to be in the streets and we need to, you know, scare them a little bit that if they do pass this egregious agreement that will permanently impact us, that we will yell even louder. So they have to be afraid of that and not willing to bring it up.
Thank you. I think that's a great rundown of what I hope listeners will do. And actually, you know, the profile of this has been raised tremendously. More work remains to be done. You know, one of the things that I just also want to ask you about so that people listening kind of are prepared for the conversation is my own experience has been that one of the biggest obstacles is, and I think this is exacerbated currently, you know, a year ago or so when we began doing these regular radio shows, actually it began in May of 2014, and you were on the show then too, Margaret, at that time. But, you know, it's been people's trust in President Obama as a president who is certainly, you know, has the appearance and in some ways has done things for which he deserves credit. And now that we see a presidential field with some very disturbing look participants, you know, I think people are even more protective in a sense of a president who isn't, you know, kind of a rabid demagogue, you know, a potential presidential candidate. And so, you know, the sense that he could be playing a two-sided game or, kind of bowing to Wall Street in their wishes in terms of these trade deals is something that is just deeply disillusioning and you know, an understanding that, you know, many people resist because, I mean, there's been a lot of wrong-headed attacks on the president, you know, that he's not an American and all of this other kind of thing. So, you know, there's also been, you know, we've been enlisted in some rightful ways in kind of defending him. And so then to turn around and think that he could be doing something as harmful as this, you know, somehow some people want to think that, you know, maybe we don't understand it properly or he couldn't be doing this. I mean, it's the words of Joseph Stiglitz, who basically traced the connection between the U.S. Trade Representative, Wall Street, and the campaign donations to the president, who, you know, in his earlier elections, that I think, you know, sadly makes a very persuasive case in that regard. But, you know, what do you recommend our listeners say, you know, to the many people who think this president is, you know, better than what we've had before and could be a lot better than what we may be facing next, you know, and maybe we're not understanding this or he couldn't be doing this. I mean, how do you address those concerns?
Well, those are really good challenges to figure out. It is an ongoing challenge. I mean, President Obama is an extremely talented speaker. He is very good at saying things in ways that people can hear them as consistent with their own views. And no matter what your view is, you can listen to him and feel that way, unless you're, you know, just a rabid opponent. But so he's very good at building that base and keeping that base on his side, and it's a very big challenge. mean, but the reality is, if you can somehow, I would take two approaches depending on the person I'm talking to. One is to kind of point out that he had throughout his cabinet and throughout his economic team, Wall Street advisors, that Michael Froman, the head of the U.S. trade rep, the ambassador, the trade ambassador, not only was a major bundler and raising money for President Obama during his campaigns, but was also a top official at Citigroup. And so he comes from that Wall Street perspective as well. And there were a number of people in the trade, U.S. trade rep's office who came from law firms that represented pharmaceuticals and a lot of big business interested revolving door activities going on there. So I think first off, to point out the makeup of the U.S. trade rep, the reality that Obama has surrounded himself with Wall Street, and the basic reality that Obama has traditionally been a Wall Street Democrat who really believes that the market dominated by Wall Street is this path to solutions. Maybe you can pierce that reality and get through people. There are more people who see it, and that's an advantage. The other thing is you point to the fact that every person running for president for the Democratic Party right now opposes the TPP, even Hillary Clinton, who had traditionally been a supporter of these kinds of trade agreements. Bernie Sanders takes probably the strongest position in opposition to these trade agreements. Martin O'Malley, as insignificant as he is, in the polls, also opposes these trade agreements. So you have unanimity on that side. There's actually a number of Republicans who oppose them as well, which is an interesting thing. So I think the fact that future Democrat leader, if they become the next president, will be an opponent of this trade agreement is also a valuable talking point. President Obama, his power is diminishing every day. His speech last night may be the high point of this year for him as far as influence on Congress goes. His arm twisting that he did for the trade agreement passing fast track will not be as effective this time. He can't promise as much to members of Congress in the future. He can't threaten as much to members of Congress in the future. It's going to be a plea of, give me this last thing for me, please. That's going to be the kind of plea. And so members of Congress have to balance it against their own political futures and their own political views and their own interests. And so I think he'll be much less effective on pushing the TPP than he has been on anything else, especially as this gets further into the election year. Once it gets into March, April, May, it's going to be really hard for members of Congress to go against their constituents if we are organized. And so the other thing is I think it's important for us to not just to focus more on those who get it and activate them, because we don't have to have every person in the country on our side. We have to, or every Democrat in the country on our side. What we have to have is people from wherever they are in the political spectrum who understand it, and to get them mobilized. If we do that, we have enough people in that position right now that we can create a grassroots, people-powered base that can, especially in election year, stop this TPU from going forward. So, I wouldn't spend too much time focusing on those who don't see the truth about Obama and his racism to Wall Street. I'd spend more time on getting the people who get it mobilized in order, and people like 350.org we talked about, who are starting to get it, get them to take action. And the other thing, whoever you support for president, whether Democrat or Republican, I assume, or Green, sorry, Margaret mentioned or Green, to get them to do more than just say they oppose the TPP. Get them to take action and say they're going to do what they can to stop the TPP. It's easy to promise you're going to do all sorts of major changes when you become president. Let's see some proof that you actually have the ability to be influential enough to actually make things happen. To me, that's it's easy to say the right things. The harder thing is to get them done. And so this is an opportunity for candidates to show they can get things done, and they can help by joining the battle against the TPP and doing something about it, not just talking about it.
Thank you. Any further thoughts from you, Margaret, on that?
I think that, for us, Kevin and I are independent of the whole Democrats and Republicans. I think we're able to kind of step back and look at but that whole picture, you know, we see kind of both of those parties as being corrupted and strongly influenced by Wall Street money. And so for us, it's really about building that political alternative outside of that kind of what we call the corporate duopoly. And that's how, you know, throughout history, that's how social change has happened, from challenging those whoever the major dominant parties are. And I think that's a power that people don't recognize. And so, you know, the issue of our time is corporate power. We have two corporate parties, and we need to be building alternatives outside of that that are not influenced by those corporate dollars. So I did want to just mention that I am running for U.S. Senate, seeking the Green Party nomination in Maryland, and hoping that we can, you know, continue to raise these issues that aren't talked about, the solutions that aren't talked about, and educate people and get them galvanized to really apply pressure to the system. And just one thing, because I know we're running out of time, but there's something that I think listeners should be aware of, because oil prices, as you probably are aware, are falling and have been falling pretty sharply, and I anticipated that they may go down even as low as $16 a barrel this year. Oil companies are going bankrupt. A number of them are, particularly the smaller ones. We just saw actually a coal company, Arch Coal, go bankrupt, which I applaud. But so the oil and gas lobbyists right now are lobbying Congress for a bailout to help protect their industry. And I see this as a tremendous opportunity where the oil and gas industry is very weak to say, no, we don't want to bail them out. Let's take those dollars that we would use to bail them out and use them to create real clean energy alternatives. So I think unless there is a public awareness and demand to prevent Congress from doing any kind of oil and gas bailout, that may happen. So we do need to be saying this is the opportunity right now to end the fossil fuel era and demand clean energy. And I just want listeners to be aware of that.
Wow, that's very important. So, listeners, you can also go to Flush the TPP and find out a little bit more about that. We have about 6 minutes left to the show. Just also because of your other site, It's Our Economy, what's your views on what is happening with our economy and, you know, with the stock market and what that implies for us in the coming year 2016, because we're still early on in the year. Would love to hear your insight on that briefly. Well,
the stock market is a symptom, really, of a much deeper problem in our economy. There's nothing under the stock market. There's no our labor force is a mess. Half the workers earn less than $30,000 a year. Poverty wages, that is down to poverty-level wages, or very near it, for half of American workforce. That's disastrous. 20 people in the nation have the wealth equal to the 150 million people at the bottom. You know, the 5% unemployment rate is a charade. It doesn't count all those who stopped even trying to find jobs, which is at record levels. It counts people who have temporary jobs, which are, often seasonal. It counts people who are part-time workers. I mean, then you have all these essentially part-time workers who don't earn enough money to live on. And we have right now a record number of people who are working multiple jobs just to get by. So all that looks terrible. At the same time, commodity prices are at lows that we haven't seen since the Depression. So commodity market's a mess. We have a massive bond bubble where people have been thinking they're investing in something safe, which are bonds, and now that's a bubble that could burst. And then you have a massive money that they've been making on bonds that is now being used to leverage into investment in derivatives, which are at the highest levels ever as well. And all of that happens at a time when the Federal Reserve, because it's been giving so much free money, or very free, nearly free money, to Wall Street, is leveraged at levels that mean it was 79-1. They're leveraging compared to Lehman Brothers was like 29-1 when it crashed. So even our Federal Reserve, which is essentially our central bank, is now over-leveraged. So if there is another crash, they won't be able to bail out Wall Street. And so that's a very scary picture of an overall economy. It's not just the stocks. The stocks are, in this case, I think, a bubble because they're built on top of nothing. as far as the U.S. economy is failing. And that's in context of a world economy. Europe's in trouble. China's in trouble. Japan's in a recession again. Brazil's in trouble. You look around the world, and there's a world high-risk economy right now. So I think Obama painted a very rosy picture last night in the State of the Union. But it's really a global economy and U.S. economy that could collapse, and many people are predicting stock market crashes that will be much deeper than 2008 and an economic collapse that's much deeper than 2008. So people should hold on to their – put their seatbelts on and hold on for a very wild ride in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think even more than holding on, it's important to be taking steps in communities to protect protect ourselves as well. And I don't mean like protect yourself as an individual, like stock up on guns and food in your house, but really to all around the world, and now really growing inside of the U.S. is a new kind of economy. It's called a solidarity, or we call it economic democracy. It's building economic institutions where people work together more cooperatively, where they people share from the benefits of those institutions. And so this is in all different sectors. We see communities that are doing cooperatively owned solar for their community. We see people that are putting in place, you know, cooperative kind of agriculture, you know, these community-supported agriculture type of programs where you support your local farmer and you get a share of the food that's produced. People are creating cooperative businesses. People are pushing for public banks as an alternative to the Wall Street banks. These are banks that we put our public dollars into, and then they have a public mission to fund projects in our communities, like starting new businesses, like building infrastructure and creating jobs that way. There is an alternative to the current economy that we have, the current economic system. And I think just seeing the fragility of this system, and if this bubble burst this year, this will be the third one in 15 years. So this is just kind of the pattern that we're in. Many economists are predicting that we're just going to have a stagnant kind of bumping along the bottom economy from here on out, because we're really bumping up against the limits of our planet. So it's time, I think, if people go to It's Our Economy, you can read more about these great alternatives that people are working on, and we encourage people to get involved in that as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese, for being with me today on Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose. We leave you. Be well.
It was dark and there was light. There was pink and there was the sky.